Hello and welcome to Dishing Up. I'm Millie.
And I'm Mariam. We're part of Larder, a magazine where we believe who you are is what you eat.
In this series, we're going to take you on a food tour around the world.
In each episode, we'll be choosing a new country to focus on and speaking to renowned chefs from that country about their earliest memories of cooking and what makes their food so delicious.
Come with us on this journey to learn about traditional food from all corners of the globe. We'll be going to places like the Gambia, Azerbaijan, Mexico, and Malta. Leave behind everything you know about food. We're headed off the beaten track.
So grab a knife and a fork, because this is Dishing Up.
If you're anything like me and terrible at geography, you might not know the location of today's episode, Azerbaijan. Having since Googled and educated myself, I can tell you that it's between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, neighbouring Georgia and Russia to the north, Armenia to the west, and Iran to the south. If you're still confused, then I can't help you.
Their scenery is dramatic and beautiful, with lowlands and mountain ranges, cities and remote villages. Azerbaijan was also part of the Soviet Union before its independence in 1991. All this, of course, has had an impact on the food.
Azerbaijan is part of the Silk Road trade route, and the main influences on Azerbaijani cuisine are Turkish, Eastern European and Iranian. A traditional meal is three courses. Firstly, a rice dish, then a kebab or shashlik. Sturgeon fish are common in the Caspian Sea, so often these are skewered and served with pomegranate sauce. Finally, the third course involves soup, where there are over 30 different kinds of soup.
Black caviar from the Caspian Sea is one of Azerbaijan's luxury food items. The national dish of Azerbaijan is plov, apparently invented by Alexander the Great to feed his army. There are as many as 40 different versions of this dish, consisting of layers of steamed basmati rice, dried fruit like apricots, raisins and plums, chestnuts and beef or lamb. Often the rice is flavoured with saffron, which you can learn more about in the Light Bite episode. Dialing in all the way from Azerbaijan today, we have Yakub Zeynalzadeh. Yakub grew up in Azerbaijan, spending his childhood summers in Daksikan with his grandmother.
He trained as a chef in Italy and Croatia before returning to Azerbaijan. At one point, he had seven jobs to try and pay back tuition fees. He then set up his business, Project Flat, in the city of Baku when he was just 25 years old.
Yakub turned his home into a restaurant for Project Flat and invites people from all over Azerbaijan to have a seat at his table. There are also volunteers who come to the restaurant to learn to cook.
Yakub, welcome to Dishing Up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I'm so happy and honored that our voice and of our small initiative have reached up all the way to the overseas and to the UK. So I'm very honored and very appreciate this opportunity so much.
Well, thank you, Yakub. It's such an honor to have you on the podcast. Do you mind telling us a bit about your earliest memories of food?
Oh, I remember from my grandma, she was telling me that once I ate the whole pot of dolma. And dolma is a dish that is my grandma's favorite dish. It's a minced meat, a little bit flavored with a mint that grows in our mountains.
Yeah.
And wrapped into preserved grape leaves. And braised in a little bit of lamb chopped juice or like a broth. Mm-hmm. And so I remember this story when I ate it. I liked it so much that I ate a lot, that I ended up in hospital when I was very young age. I was like, I think like 2 years old, 3 years old.
And you ended up in hospital because you ate so much?
Yeah, I ate it like so much of it. So.
My gosh.
We have a poet and philosopher from Ganja. It's called Nizami Ganjavi, and there are his words that I could quote. So that it says, even the water, if you drink a lot, even the water that contains life, if you drink it a lot, it can harm you. So I didn't know that back then. So I ate it a lot. So I ended up in a hospital when doctors were trying to, you know, to give me some medicine. And I was like a small child and trying to keep myself from having that medicine. Because I remember when I was a child, I would visit my grandma. And every time we come to visit our grandma, we would bring some, you know, some watches and some electrical equipment, which we would share with other our neighbor farmers. And in exchange, they would give us some tomatoes, some fresh eggs, and so on. But years passed, farmers moved away, villagers moved away, and the traditions disappeared. And now, like, you know, a couple of years ago, when I went back to the village to visit my grandma, our neighbors, which were like older in age now, they asked me to bring them some of the vegetables from the market. And that was very, very unfortunate situation that a lot of youths have moved from the villages, and there's no one almost left to continue this heritage of farming, and local varieties are disappearing. So I kind of took this as a motivation to overcome this challenge and tell the stories of these ingredients to people. So actually, I'm more of a storyteller and a social entrepreneur. So cooking is just my passion. I love doing things with my hand, cooking and crafting some wood. And this is a way to help me to express my story and to tell people how the local ingredients are important, how the seasonality is important. Because speaking about doctors and unfortunate situations, the nature around us, I believe, it feels our needs, and in the season the nature gives back to us what we take from ourselves and what the, you know, the climate could take from ourselves. So by feeding ourselves seasonally, we actually heal. Actually, we let the nature heal us through its minerals, vitamins, and processes itself. So the cooking is actually considered as a healing.
That's really interesting. Thank you so much. And who was it that first taught you to cook? Was it your grandmother?
Yeah, mostly I grew up by observing my grandma, how she would cook and give us the care, how she clean up. And this is what I love right now as well. This is how I transfer and speak my love language, as sharing food and taking care of others and cleaning up and trying to have, you know, less, more organized and less mess. And yeah, basically, the food is a language of love for me to communicate my care.
We've learned that you trained as a chef in Italy and Croatia. So what was it like working in that environment for the first time?
This is a totally different experience, because cooking at home and observing grandma is a beginning of the passion. But when you're in the academy, it is a totally different experience. You are getting trained by chefs. You're getting trained by local culture. You're indulging in the culture and discovering the differences of the techniques. And this is a lot of colors surrounding you. Also, ingredients are different in different countries, but also some are similar. But also, you discover how everything is different, but also is the same in terms of human intelligence. Because as human, it doesn't matter where we live, we tend to do this more like alike decisions, like combination of techniques, and coming up with the same ideas of playing with the food, whether it's Chinese dumplings or Italian alveolo or Azerbaijani dushpara. So this is different cultures, different countries, different people, different races, but all have the same human intelligence that came up with the same solution, with the same approach of putting together, creating a beautiful dish, just different names. So cooking in that different country and observing different culture gave me this idea of how everything is diverse, but yet it had this like common line that gathers everything around. And also the feasting, how is important. But the learning and studying in academy gave me a lot of idea about Croatian cuisine. Also, even though it was an Italian cuisine program. And then I went to Italy because it was a joint degree, and I indulged more in the Italian cuisine, and I've learned the power of storytelling, to be honest, how farmers are proud of their ingredients, and they would go deeper, and they would turn just the wind coming from the mountains into their power, and then using the situation to cure meats and to make the Parmigiano Reggiano, prosciutto di crudo. And so this was like more details, which I really loved hearing those stories and using the ingredients and working in a restaurant when it comes it is totally different than studying in a culinary school, because part of our program was to go to be a trainee in a restaurant. And working in a restaurant, I discovered that it's a totally different discipline requirement. It's a different dedication, attention to detail. And it was a Michelin star restaurant, which everything should be, you know, in a close to perfection. And it's the perfection of a chef. The chef is trying to achieve this by communicating his thoughts to the people. And even though it's a whole team, but it's a teamwork.
That sounds really interesting. Could you tell us what one ingredient is that you couldn't live without?
It's a good question. I have to think about it. I think passion is the ingredient that I couldn't live without, because if I don't have a passion, I often tend to change even my area of work. I used to work with farmers in regional development, but at some point I realized that I didn't have passion to just telling people what to do right and expecting them to change. So I decided to become that change, and I influenced by the thoughts that I was telling them, and I decided to stop my career. And that was the moment when I moved to this apartment and I started implementing what I was advising to the farmers and trying to, you know, to follow my passion. And I think the passion is an ingredient, and it's a very powerful ingredient which could create a difference.
No, that's really beautiful. That's such a nice answer, Jakob. And I wanted to ask a bit more about Project Flat. I mean, I know you've spoken a bit about the farmers, but what was the actual thing that, you know, pushed you to start this project?
So there are different influences in this project. First of all, what pushed me to start this project at this place, it was lack of resources. Because I didn't have much of a resources to open a restaurant or open an academy or to start like a public kitchen and so on. But I had just enough resources to move to this apartment and trying to figure out what I should do next. And when I was sitting at home and I was questioning that, okay, I have all this knowledge about value chain development, about regional development, about marketing and business and all that. So this kind of gave me a drive that I started, I went up. And I stand up and I started to cook, and I posted just some photo on my Instagram account as a joke that I'm cooking at home if anyone wants to join. And a friend of mine shared it, and then two people interested, and then they came. I was like, what should I ask as a price? I don't know how to define a value for this. I've been always consulting others, but right now I'm in the stage that I'm a little bit shy to ask for money. And even if I ask, how much do I ask? I kept questioning and questioning. So I decided that I should ask for people. And then when they said that this is the value for this experience, I realized that, you know, I should continue doing this. And this way I can actually earn some income, and I can be using those ingredients from the farmers. So this created this monetization, which I would host people at my home and cook for them and tell them stories of ingredients. But on the other hand, it would allow me to still communicate and keep that communication with the farmers, supplying those ingredients directly from them and giving them also economic income, you know, economic help. And on the other hand, also, I needed to help with the cooking. So I applied the same approach to the cooking as well. And in a short amount of time, we gathered volunteers that would help me to cook in the kitchen, that would help me to communicate and to do this graphic designs and branding and social media help. And I was very worried at the beginning, but just a year later, I was able to already, train more than 20 volunteers. And I become to the point that I was able to even pay them, and so they would earn as a pocket money, but they would earn actually a more higher salary than the regular workers work and earn. So it was a success story for me. And this is what makes Project Flat as a laboratory and a social entrepreneurship, where the local and seasonal ingredients come and turn into foods, and their stories are told, and this whole process is happening through the youth that are helping and learning at the same time and receiving that free education and also farmers receive all that consultancy that usually bigger brands have them, you know, resources to purchase. Also, they receive this for free, and we also get to, you know, inform public about those ingredients and that beauty and biodiversity of Azerbaijan, and raise awareness about extincting varieties, raise awareness about, you know, huge urbanization and people migrating to urban areas.
Oh, that sounds so inspirational. It really sounds like it's a community project. So yeah, thank you for telling us all about it. It's brilliant. Could I ask, you know, obviously you've got a lot of people coming into your restaurant or your flat even, and what's sort of your favorite traditional Azerbaijani dish to serve?
It depends on the season, to be honest. Each season has its own beauty and its own ingredient and its own technique. I love to go deeper in the techniques. And for example, now it's the spring season is coming. So the spring season is a season that, you know, all the greeneries are there. You have a lot of eggs and asparagus. And so we're trying to make this green kotap, which is a vegetarian dish that has a little bit of cheese in it and a lot of mountain herbs. And it's a flatbread wrapped in both sides. And then we have dora, which is another dish that my grandma used to cook for us. And it's very popular in the area of Ganja, where I grew up mainly. And dora is a dish that is made with a yogurt, with a sour yogurt. And it has also a lot of herbs from all over the mountains. And some people add there a little bit of rice just to make it concentrated, you know, more consistency. People add a little, my grandma used to add an egg, and this dish is a dish that you should be giving a lot of care of yours, so you should be stirring it until it's boiled or it's cooked, and you should not stop, and you should not stir it in a different directions. We have to maintain one direction until it's cooked and keep stirring, which is a fun activity that gives me a smile when I remember about my childhood. So this is a favorite dish that we cook in the spring. When it's winter, for example, I love to cook meat, because that is the time when we have a better and best meat. And also, my observation in the mountains of Azerbaijan showed that in some periods, the population of the animals are very high, and as a human growing in wilderness, our ancestors, this is considered in the whole world, we observe how animals hunt, and we start also consuming the meat only in this period, but also sharing it with each other, and then giving it a value and giving it a praise. In the summer, I use beautiful vegetables, and I love to cook with the vegetables. I love to use the techniques that are coming from Nankaram. This is a technique that a friend of mine taught coming from his mom. It's a technique of using properly the fire and using the pan, and then the heat of the pan, and then using a little bit of garlic just to season all beautiful vegetables. And there's a simple dish called sirdar. It is an eggplant, tomatoes, and a little bit of garlic, and it gives a beautiful, beautiful harmony of taste, especially using the sourdough, which I use all the seasons. Yeah, I'm getting hungry.
So are we.
We are as well, don't worry. That all sounds so delicious. Jakob, is there a specific dish from Azerbaijan that you wish more people knew about, one that you think is quite underrated?
Generally, touching this theme, when I was in Lankaran, speaking about Lankaran, I've heard that there is a dish called tara. So tara is a dish that is made, but this is a name to call wild, unnamed herbs. Also, a dish that is made, a spread that is made by these unnamed wild herbs that grow by themselves, called tara as well. Basically, the tara idea and the idea of a pesto is exactly the same. And this gave me this idea about all the dishes, all the techniques, all the dishes that we see in the world. And I realized that each part of the world has its own pesto or its own tara or its own type of techniques that they use. Some communicate it, and when during the communication of the dishes, some people tend to use its name, some people tend to use its recipe, and some people tend to, you know, use the other names for this. But this is what I was surprised by, because some people, when they know about pesto, which is an Italian spread of wild herbs, and some people didn't know about tara. And when I knew about it, I was surprised. Also, some people, even in Lankaran, they thought that this dish is only made with spinach. However, when I started speaking with the elderly people and digging it deeper, I realized that actually each season, they use the herbs that are available in the nature. And it is in order to make it more concentrated, they add rice a little bit. And that is how they obtain that herbal spread. And when I dig deeper in Italy, I realized that the whole world knows a pesto as a basil bread. But it appears that in Italy, pesto is also not just a basil bread, but they use things that are around and that are green, and they make the concentrate by using an olive oil, a little bit of nuts, which is not pine nuts always, but any nut that is available in the region, and adding their potatoes, sometimes rice. Again, the things to concentrate and that are around under their hand.
For this part of the podcast, we'd like you to imagine you're preparing a dinner party menu full of your favourite Azerbaijani dishes. So could you tell us what you're having for starter, main, dessert and to drink?
So a year ago, I took a trip, finally, with an old van that I've been restoring with my dad. And I finally made it to the very remotest village of Tashkent, where my ancestors were from. And I parked there, and I started living in a van for a week and started to research the lifestyle of the farmers, their ingredients, their seasonality, and how they treat their, you know, the food and so on. So I went down and I met some local villagers in there, and they took me pasturing some animals. They took me to their houses. They made me a herbal tea and so on. So after I came back from that trip, I designed this menu, which is called A Day in a Village. So in that 7-course meal experience, we started our day, and I was recording a video at that visit to the village. And I started playing those videos, and our dinner would start with an appetizer imitating a breakfast of a farmer with just a fresh bread and cheese and some tea, a herbal tea. And then the room gets more lighter, so we add up a little bit of light, and we would boil some thyme, which would give a flavor of the mountains, since it's a mountain herb, to just give that feeling, and we would play that time lapse of a sunrise in the village with all that bird sounds. And then we would move into the next appetizer. And in the next appetizer, it's already going to the morning. So the farmers already had their food, and now they're preparing to take the animals into the pasture. So what happens is there's a common pasture. So one person in a village takes the whole animal of the village, the pasture, and every day it goes in a row, and every person from each house in the village takes the animal of the whole village. So it gives them a communal pasture and more time to do things that are home. So the story of the dinner would continue as the grandma of this young shepherd would prepare some food for him to be eaten along the pastoral way. And that was that doha, which is a soup made of herbs and some bread, a mountain bread. It's layered with butter and cooked in an oven. If you've been in villages, usually they have like this big cast ovens, which is always burning. So that they also use this to heat the house, also to cook something on it. Also some ketan, which is again what I told you earlier. So this would be three appetizer and a soup that is in the dinner. And so the breakfast of the farmer is amuspush, and the appetizers are the food that grandma gives to the pasture, to the shepherd, to take to him with him to the pasture. And then he would be in the pasture and he would receive some meat from the tribes. It's nomad tribes. They also go and pasture their animals high up in the mountains for a longer stay. So they would receive some of that meat, that the young shepherd would receive some of that meat from them. And while he's pasturing, he would prepare his main dish. So his main dish would be a choban bulama, which is a pasture's broiled meat with herbs. So, and in my imagination, I needed to put some twist in there for a main dish. So I assume that the shepherd fell asleep, and shepherd saw a dream. And while he was dreaming and sleeping, this dish would keep boiling and boiling and boiling and become tender. So the potatoes become mashed potato cream and the meat becomes soft and tender, so that I use tenderloin on this. And then the sauce goes down and down and becomes a meat sauce, which I add the demi glaze sauce on that. So this story of this gourmet dish is actually a story of a main dish when the shepherd falls asleep, and then when he wakes up, he says that his food is burned, but actually it becomes even tastier and more flavorful. And that was our main dish. And for the dessert, I use I'm getting a little hungry again. So for the dessert, I use rose petals that are usually grown around that area, and are cooked under the sun for 40 days and aged for a year at least. And I would make just a small farmer's cheesecake using those.
That sounds delicious and very elaborate at the same time, I would say. Wow.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I would steep a tea, just to conclude the meal. I would steep a tea with the mountain herbs and some, you know, what I saw in those villages is another difference is that the animal and also people eat this beech nuts. And also they use the bark of a beech tree to make a tea. So I was serving that beech tree and then thyme from the mountain herb. And I would also add the rosehip syrup on top of the cheesecake to just conclude that flavor, both from petals and from the fruit of rosehip. And this would conclude the story of a shepherd. I skipped some courses, but I don't want to just keep telling you the whole thing. Maybe one day I'll be able to cook that whole menu for you, and you'll be able to get to that process more. Thank you.
That would be absolutely amazing, honestly. Jakob, if we had the budget, we'd fly right over. I wanted to ask a bit about the tea. Obviously, we're using thyme and bark, tree bark. Is that not quite bitter or quite... I'm guessing it's not a sweet tea.
Actually, the tea has a not very strong flavor. Of a bitterness or so on, but it has a color definitely coming, like a red to darker brown color coming, depending on how much we steep it. This is a herbal tea, and we can keep steeping it for a longer period, and it has this beautiful flavor coming from this from the thyme, and you just feel like you're in the mountains, and you can feel that wood, you know, smell, which is very inspiring. And I think it also has some relaxation benefits as well. But also, we must be careful, because this is a tea that is consumed high up in the mountains when people are used to different type of a pressure, blood pressure level. So in the cities, I tend to just to not, overdrink this type of tea, which is a totally different pressure level.
Yeah, no, that sounds really intriguing, actually.
Well, thank you, Jakob, so much for coming on to the podcast today. It's been really, really great to have you, and I feel like we've learned so much, so thank you.
Yeah, I mean, Azerbaijan isn't really a place that's, or a cuisine that's quite well known in the UK. I mean, I didn't know too much about it either. So this has been really, really interesting. Jakub, where can people find you on social media?
On social media, our profile is projectflat, that's us. We will be able to host more people. And we will be able to train more people as a laboratory and academy. Because right now I've been doing the whole of these things in my 18 square meter apartment. So hopefully we will get that bigger creative space. And this year will be this foundation of that ideological foundation of the whole process. And maybe even first steps will be made. Well, let's hope for the best.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Yeah, thank you again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to know you and to speak with you. And I'm looking forward to meet you. And please let me know when you will be in Azerbaijan, or I'll definitely let you know if I'll be visiting UK. And who knows? The world is small. And thank you for bringing and highlighting.
No, of course. And I think after hearing your 7-course menu, we will definitely be on the first plane we possibly can.
Thanks, Jakub.
Thank you. Have a great evening. And thank you for sharing our story.
Well, thank you for telling it.
We've been your hosts, Millie and Mariam.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of Dishing Up.
Dishing Up is produced by Mariam Aziz, Millie Jackson and Hannah Rashbass, with technical support from Maria Martinez Ugarteche.
Special thanks to Biscuit Town for our fabulous jingle. Please join us again for another tasty episode on Dishing Up.
Until then, keep cooking.
And remember, who you are is what you eat.
Bye.